Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today we're going to kick off the new year with a look at American agriculture through the lens of a new book that takes a very personal, up-close view of farming and its many challenges and opportunities. I know there's listeners out there that farm, and I think you're really going to enjoy this book and relate to it because it tells many stories of the generational ownership of farms that's passed down through generations to folks, and the many challenges and opportunities, the hardships, but also just the beauty of farming and the close emotional connection that farmers have with the earth. So I've been looking forward to this interview for a while. The book is called Land Rich, Cash Poor, My Family's Hope and the Untold History of the Disappearing American Farmer. It's written by Brian Reisinger, and he's my guest today. Brian, thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
My mom lived part of her life on a farm, and she just had such an emotional connection, and I have some of her. In fact, I'm looking at one I've got on my wall that says something about growing up on a farm is my greatest memory. So I know a lot of people out there have that connection. Talk a little bit first, if you would, about where this is located. So it's not that far from here, so our viewers will have an idea. And maybe just what really motivated you to write this very personal book?
Absolutely. Well, our farm is based in the Driftless area, southern Wisconsin. So we're not too far from you, as you say. And I think we've all probably driven through one another's beautiful country at different points in our lives. We're a fourth generation farm. We've been there since 1912 when my great grandparents escaped pre-World War I Europe to find a better life. And we've got a story that weaves through, like so many farm families, weaves through surviving subsistence farming, Great Depression, more modern crises like the farm crisis, the 1980s. And we tell all those personal stories and we weave them with the hidden errors of history that are driving the disappearance of our farms. Why is it that so many family farms year after year continue to be, you know, really driven out of existence? And, you know, why I wrote it, that story has been with me from the beginning. I've been carrying it around. I talk about how I worked with my dad from the time I could walk. And from the moment I can remember understanding the English language, I don't know when does that light flicker, maybe three or four. I remember guys driving into my dad's driveway with the pickup and saying, you know, well, this farm sold or that farm went under. You know, I've grown up with it like so many of your listeners. And I want to answer that question. So when I got off the farm to pursue my writing career in business journalism and then in public policy, I saw an economy and a political system that really been leaving farm families like ours behind. And so, you know, that led me to answering that question that I've been carrying around for quite a long time.
No, you come at this again from a personal angle, because like so many, and this has been written about quite a bit, where younger people are not choosing to go and inherit and work the farm. And you face that pressure as well, and you deal with it very honestly, the guilt aspect. Can you share a little bit about that and how you've managed that as you've gotten older?
Thank you for asking about that. You know, we decided we were going to tell all the raw stories that we had, and there's stories like that. There's stories of addiction. There's all kinds of things that we talk about, and we decided we'd be honest. As a family, we talked about that. And my part of that is being honest about my struggle. I was the first eldest son in four generations not to farm. I was also the first son on my dad's side of the family to go to college. So there was both pride and guilt there. And, you know, I grew up feeling like I should do as my father did. And he was very supportive and loving of what I wanted to do. But the truth is, and we've talked about this, if he could wave a magic wand and have my skill and passion be farming, he would have done it. And I would have waved that wand too. I loved where I grew up. I loved working on the farm. I loved having those roots, but I didn't have the talent for cattle and crops that he did. And I struggled with that for a long time. And what I found is that by finding my own way, I found my way back. And so my own way was going out and pursuing a writing career. And I'm so grateful for the roots I had as I did that, because it helped me see the parts of our country that were being left behind. And, you know, I came back around two things. I returned to Wisconsin, and I'm grateful that my dad is still farming. My sister's taken over, which is such a proud thing for us. And, you know, I help out on the business side of the farm by virtue of some of the experiences I've had in my career. And that, you know, like many a farm kid, they throw me in a tractor on my quote unquote days off. So I'm grateful that it's there, and I'm grateful to be part of it. But I had to find my own way, and I wrestled with that for a while. And it, you know, it contributed to a lot of shame and guilt. It contributed toward a drinking issue that I dealt with that I'm very honest about in the book, and I'm glad to have overcome, because you have that weight of each generation and you feel that you're supposed to do your part. And so part of telling this story is maybe me laying that down a little bit and trying to tell my part.
You know, I found myself putting the book down after I read about that and thinking of my own story, which is comparable but not the same. And my family, my dad's forefathers for seven straight generations fought in wars and served in the military. And I didn't do that. And sometimes I struggled with that a bit, that maybe I wasn't doing my part. So in some way, I really related to it. You know, I talked to my dad about it, and of course he was like, oh no, you know, you're fine without doing it. But I feel, looking back, that I missed something. But I've kind of managed and gone on, I guess, with it.
Well, as you say, they're distinct, but they're so similar. And I think that, you know, we often feel the need to live up to our fathers or our parents one way or another. And when you have a family that's done some proud and honorable things, there's part of that. I've also learned that there's different ways to carry something forward. And, you know, I mean, I can't speak for your dad, but in my dad's case, part of him wanted me to farm, and part of him was so glad that there was other opportunity for me. And some of these things are proud things to have gone through, but some of them are hard things, particularly in the case of serving our country as well. And, you know, so it's complicated, and fathers and sons and families are complicated.
I've never farmed, but I read, I felt the connection when you wrote the part about the very painful decision to sell cows, sell your cows. And can you talk about that, as far as, I thought it was very interesting how your farm had to adapt to meet changing conditions. And this was really at your sister's direction.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we'd been a dairy farm milking cows for more than a century in southern Wisconsin, from my great grandparents all the way through to my sister and my generation. And, you know, as we got along here and we get, you know, we went through COVID. My dad had a very serious case of COVID that affected his health. He came back from it, but it really put the farm in doubt for a while. My sister had to carry things forward at that time. We tell that story and just the economics of it and other factors in our lives. We were a 50 cow dairy farm, and it was becoming impossible to continue on at that scale. So we either needed to get much bigger, hundreds or thousands, and some families make that decision, or we needed to shift gears. And we wanted to shift gear. We had to do one or the other before it got to the point that you could lose everything, you know? And, you know, whether it's debt or waiting too long to face these decisions, there's so many farms that are wiped out because they're just trying to figure out a way to keep doing what they're doing. And we understand that struggle. So we diversified, as you say, and we sold our dairy herd. We continued to raise heifers for other dairy farms. We raise beef for consumers, and we also cash crop. And so we're trying to do what we can to continue to operate on a small scale. We're constantly trying to figure out, where else do we evolve? Is there a new market in some element of what people want from our farmers as we care more and more about where our food comes from? We're constantly trying to continue figuring out that evolution. But we're grateful to have made it through. We're grateful to have our land. At the same time, you know, the closest thing I compare it to is selling the cows is like a death in the family. And that's what it was like for my dad. And it was a deep emotional struggle, one that took us a while to work through.
For the benefit of our listeners who are not familiar with farming, agriculture, the title, I've heard the title before, people talking about it in this area, but you might just explain a little bit what that means, land rich, cash poor. A lot of people would think, wait a minute, that's contradictory.
Yes, absolutely. It is a dilemma. It's a paradox that farmers live. You're right. It's been around. So land rich, cash poor, what that means is that you got this land that is so incredibly valuable, but so hard to make a living on. So the cash poor part of that, it's getting harder and harder each year for farms to be able to make a living. And there's a lot of reasons for that that we get into, but it's getting harder and harder to grind out that living. And so those families, they have to, those moms and dads are trying to figure out if there's a point where they have to tell their family, we can't make it doing this, Now you can turn around and sell it, and it's valuable, and there's a, there's money for the family to do that at that time. But then in doing so, you lose everything else, because when you grow up on a farm, it's not only your mom or dad's job, but it's your home, it's your community, it's your heritage, in our case, going back four generations. So land rich, cash poor, it's a trap that farmers who are being left behind in this country are in, which is you can't continue making a living in many cases, but boy, if you sell it, you lose everything else. So it's a tricky situation, and it's one that's wound up in a lot of economic and emotional hardship.
I thought your ending and the story of the eagle was just really brilliant, nice way to end the story. I'd like you to talk about that. And the quote, and you mentioned how your farm adapted, but your quote was, the answers for the future lay in the past. Yeah. And then you bring in the story of the eagle, and it's a beautiful closing to your story.
Yeah. Well, thank you. As we wove our country's history of these issues that have driven the disappearance of our farms, and I wove that with my family's story, and we told both those stories, I felt like we were finding places in our history where we made, as a country, made a decision or went a path that we didn't need to. And so by uncovering this hidden history, I hope that we've revealed some places where we can find new paths forward. And on a personal level, the story of the eagle demonstrated that for us, because my grandpa Albert is a character in the story. He grew up in two decades of poverty and climbed into the middle class after the Depression. And he will always be the generation that accomplished that for our family. He was a kind man, wonderful man. He also, because of what he grew up with, had a drinking problem for the better part of his life. And so he exemplifies, as well as anybody, the beauty and the hardship of this life. And, after we had sold the cows, we were so fearful of what was going to happen. And we were in a moment where we were trying to figure out how we were going to sell our corn and get it to the right bidder, and whether we were going to be able to do that. We're trying to find new customers. And, during this moment of fear, this eagle flew through. And my grandpa had always called me Eagle Bird when I was a kid. It was a nickname he had. And I get emotional thinking about it. But he, whenever we see the eagle, we always think it's probably grandpa watching over us. And that day that he flew through the yard, I guess I say he flew through the yard, we found a new customer for our corn. There was a local farmer that needed it at just the right time. And, I guess when you grow up close to the land, you don't think those things are coincidences. And I just love the idea of him flying down there through, watching us, maybe liberated from the drink and other things that had burdened him in his life.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. And today I'm very pleased to kick off our new year with discussing a book on America's number one industry, agriculture. It's a very personal book, and we've focused a little bit here with the author on the first half of our interview on the personal angle. The book's called Land Rich and Cash Poor. Land Rich, Cash Poor: My Family's Hope and the Untold History of the Disappearing American Farmer. He's Brian Reisinger. Brian, the title talks about untold history. And I thought, I wonder what that could be. But then I read it and found some things that I will admit that I was aware of, but I didn't tie them in to the story and the history of agriculture. And one right off the bat is what you call the Forgotten Depression. Can you talk about that a little?
That one surprised me. So the whole country went into the Great Depression, of course, in 1929. Something that I learned in the research for this book and that I realized my grandparents would have lived through is that there was an agricultural depression in the 1920s, a full decade before the rest of the country had a depression. And what happened is after World War One, America was ready to feed a battle-weary Europe. Their agriculture and their economy was crushed, and we were ready to feed them. And so we had this big ramp up in agriculture. And suddenly, you know, Europe was able to rebuild itself a little quicker than people thought. And we had all of this capacity to grow all this food. And suddenly there wasn't the market for it that we thought there would be. So the prices started plummeting. And that kicked off a rural financial crisis, kind of like we saw in the Great Recession, where, you know, one bank to another started falling. That happened in the 1920s, except for it was really only with rural banks, farm banks. And, you know, so by the time the whole country was plunged in the Great Depression, farmers had been knocked on their back 10 years earlier and had been going through fits and starts of recovery and depression for years by that time. And I was shocked to hear that. And it's a perfect example of the hidden history. With each chapter, we tried to tell a hidden story beneath the surface that would have driven the disappearance of farms in that era. And, you know, I learned that, you know, my grandpa and grandma grew up not only in the Great Depression, but in years of depression before that. So they had, when he was in boyhood and she was in girlhood, they were growing up in depression. And in fact, my grandpa's family, there were 14 kids from 1913 all the way to 1936, 23 years worth of kids. And all of them were either born into or came of age during economic depression, which was just a shocking thing to learn.
You talked about that the post-World War II era should have been better. You know, there we were with Europe, Japan, you know, bombed out, really in no place really to grow crops. But yet, and if I were to ask this, I'll bet I would be wonder how many people would get this right. You said the largest five-year drop in the number of farms in U.S. history. I'll let the listeners think about that for a minute. The largest five-year drop of the number of farms in U.S. history, I would have guessed back in the 30s. It was 1954 to 1959, the Eisenhower era. What happened there? Why didn't the post-World War II era, why didn't agriculture do better?
You're picking some of the most shocking parts that shocked me the most as I investigated them. You're right. It wasn't the Depression. It wasn't the farm crisis of the 1980s. It was the 1950s, an era of prosperity for much of the country, including for those farmers who made it. But what was happening at that time in our country is the family farm was going from the early 1900s of you know, working out what farming looked like in this country and getting through the Depression and emerging from that. And what they emerged into was this massive industrial economy that was much, much bigger than the one that we'd had when we all went into the Depression. And it was bigger in terms of bigger business, industries that were dominated by large companies all across the American economy. And it was dominated by larger government as well, that had intervened during the Depression. And we've had a debate ever since in this country about how much of that government presence should continue or not continue in agriculture and other industries. And there's room for that respectful debate. The reality, regardless of what people think of those different components, is that the family farm was emerging into an economy dominated by big. And so that creates all kinds of pressure for farms to get bigger or to get out. And so what we had is we had farms that were making it and were climbing further into the middle class, but it was a very fragile climb. And we also had a lot of family farms that were wiped out because they just didn't have the economic scale to make it anymore. Because for one reason or another, they weren't able to take advantage of the market or the government programs there that were designed to help. They just began to get lost in the shuffle. And I think the reason that it was such a pronounced drop in the number of family farms is actually ironically because it was during a good time, because we all, I wasn't there, but the country and so many people, my grandparents would say this too, they were climbing further middle class. People thought things were good. But sometimes what I've found over and over throughout this story is farms do bad during the bad times. And then during the good times, there's a certain segment of farms that are still struggling with those same structural issues, and we're missing it. We're not realizing it. And so I think it was so pronounced in part because it was just so unexpected that it would be happening.
The next era that I thought you really did a good job of tying two significant parts of history together, that if you put yourself in the place of an American farmer, you would go, whoa, I mean, government policy is almost schizophrenic here. That's the Nixon policy, and then the Carter grain embargo. If you could kind of that was another great part of the book, that it truly is kind of an untold history. I thought you did a great job there with that. But kind of tie those together, if you would.
Yeah, you know, I'm always clear with people when I talk about this. Each of these policies and others in that era and throughout the book, we can argue in favor or against them. And you can have a discussion and debate, whether it's from right or left, or whether it's within the industry, outside the industry. We can have a discussion around, did each of these individual things make sense or not? But the challenge that we have is, regardless of viewpoint, is that when these things all get strung together, the disaster they create. So what happened in the 70s is that the Nixon administration negotiated, among other things, a very large deal to sell grain into the Soviet Union. And that created a new market for farmers, which was good because that increased their prices. They had more places to sell. There was more demand. It also, in the minds of not only the Nixon administration, but also Republican and Democratic administrations before and since, there was a growing belief that, quote unquote, food is a weapon. That's what Nixon's Ag Secretary Earl Butz said. And he spoke the truth of the time, I think. I think there were various people felt that way. And the idea was, we can benefit our farmers and we can also wield leverage over the communists in Soviet Russia. Because if we're feeding them, they need that. They have something they need from us. So it was a diplomatic tool. It was the view. Later, not long after that, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and President Carter felt that he needed to have a response to that. And so he instituted the embargo against Russia that included a grain embargo, stopping the sale. And, you know, the other thing that was going on at this time is that government under both parties had also been encouraging farmers to take out more debt, including with government programs. And then we, of course, had to increase interest rates to deal with inflation. And so that debt was made more expensive. So you had a government that encouraged sales to Soviet Russia and then shut it down, and encouraged debt and then made it more expensive. And you can argue for or against those things. But when they happen in concert, without anyone stopping and saying, wait a minute, what happens to the farmer? What you have is farmers are the collateral damage of those whipsawing government policies. And so those combination of things is what kicked off the farm crisis of the 1980s, when we lost tens of thousands of farms, really in a heartbreakingly needless way.
Yeah, the farm crisis of the 80s, you can't look at as an isolated event. It's a lot of, there was some issues that go back to the 60s that you just described that led to that, which, you know, everybody's familiar with the farm crisis of the 80s, but you do a great job of, again, this untold story, bringing other events in that set the table for it. And one thing I'll just tell, excuse me, our listeners here, in these partisan times, this is not a partisan book. I mean, this is, I have no idea what your politics are. And that's why I enjoyed reading it, because it takes an objective look at this and tells it from a very personal viewpoint. The next major event was the trade wars. We're getting near to current times here, back in the late 2010s. That had a big impact too, and then you had COVID on top of that in 2020.
Yeah, you know, the modern crises that we've faced follow some of the same patterns, in that there's unknown things happening. Our country doesn't realize the unique way that farm families are affected. And whether it was globalization and the prosperity of the 90s, that was a good thing, but again, was an era of leaving farms behind, or whether it was COVID, so many people remember during COVID not having the food they were looking for in the grocery store, or if they did, it was much more expensive. And what was happening at that time was farm families were finding that it was harder to sell their goods, or if they could, it was for a lower price. And the reason was that our supply chain was locked up. So by now we have this large integrated food system where there are too few paths for the food to get from the farm gate to the dinner table. So if you have a large distribution center go down, it suddenly locks up that supply chain. And the farmer on the beginning of that supply chain isn't able to sell their goods. And the consumer on the receiving end of that supply chain isn't able to buy their goods. So you have this dystopian situation where farmers can't sell and consumers can't buy. And what is going on? And so these are modern crises that continue to really rack farm families. And I think it just continues to be proof of the fact that our country doesn't always understand how issues are affecting our farm families. And it's kind of occurring in what you and I might understand some folks consider flyover country. And I think it's important to try to fight that impulse and make sure we look these things in the face.
You close the book with some recommendations, and I'm not going to get into all of them. I recommend folks buy the book and see for themselves. And we barely touched on a lot of what's in this book. But I wanted to talk about the big issue is how big farms have gotten. And I know there's a movement to kind of bring us back to the ideal. I think if people said the 1950s, we've just disproven that was going in the opposite direction. But what do you think this issue of trying to rein in big farms? I think that's one thing that struck me that you were taking a very objective view towards.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate that. I guess the most honest way that I could tell people we deal with that in the book is we wrestle with it, because there's no question that bigger farms creates pressure on smaller farms. It creates pressure for all farms to get bigger. At the same time, those bigger farms, what they're doing is they're trying to survive in the same way that other farms are. And they're chasing, trying to keep up with the agribusiness companies that are getting bigger, who are trying to keep up with the food companies who are getting bigger. The food industry is trying to keep up with the rest of industry in America to get bigger. And so what I say, what I do in the book is we acknowledge and we report out some of the negative impacts of having so much big in our economy. We also try to be honest about what are the forces that drove that. It's a systematic, system-wide issue in our economy that drove that. So how can we all work together to try to address those issues? And what I believe and what I think the hidden history of our disappearing farmer shows is that there's a place for small and mid-sized farms to have their own markets in this country, while at the same time there are other larger farms that are growing most of our food right now. We can evolve this situation. We can find a way. We just have to reject the false choices of the past. And I think we need to have a world where small and medium-sized farms can make it. We still have nearly 2 million farms in this country, and people are amazed to hear that 96% of them are family farms. And a lot of those farms are small farms that they're just supplemental income. They're not full-time income for their families right now. So the families are working 2-3 jobs while also farming. What if we could find a way for those farms to be a meaningful part of our food supply and other new entrepreneur opportunity in the future? You got nearly 2 million farm families trying to make it, holding on, despite the fact that this isn't working. Imagine if we made it work. And so that's what I try to encourage people to think about near the end of the book there.
Positive solutions, and I think realistic solutions without necessarily an ideological or partisan edge. That's what I really liked about it. And it's born of your experience, both on the farm and as a journalist. And I appreciate that. Again, the book is called Land Rich, Cash Poor, My Family's Hope and the Untold History of the Disappearing American Farmer. My guest is the author, Brian Reisinger. Brian, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Well, I really appreciate you having me. People can find Land Rich, Cash Poor on Amazon and other places online, also bookstores nationwide. And I just hope that anybody who picks it up just continues the conversation on these issues. There's such an important heritage and impact that this has, not only on rural America, but on the dinner table of every American.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.